Welcome everybody to the first session, Mediterranean France. I'm going to introduce all of the panelists and then they will take their turn. Jessica Marglin offers the first paper, Mediterranean French Modern, the Trans-Imperial Life of Abraham Andawa, 1810 to 1890, soon to be published in article form in Jewish Social Studies. She received her PhD from Princeton in Near Eastern Studies and since this fall is assistant professor and Ruth Ziegler Early Career Chair in Jewish Studies at the School of Religion at the University of Southern California. Author of several articles, book chapters, and conference presentations, her work focuses on the Jewish experience in North Africa, in particular in 19th century Morocco. The next presenter, Ethan Katz, received his doctorate from the University of Wisconsin in 2009. He is currently an assistant professor at the University of Cincinnati. He has a book, The Burdens of Brotherhood, Jews and Muslims from North Africa to France, forthcoming from Harvard, and a co-edited volume, Secularism in Question, Jews and Judaism in Modern Times, which is soon to be published by the University of Pennsylvania Press. His paper today addresses Jews, Muslims, and mainland France between the wars. Our third paper is given by Todd Shepard, who is Associate Professor of History and Co-Director of the Program in the Study of Women, Gender, and Sexuality at Johns Hopkins University. He publishes widely on decolonization, more specifically on the impact of the Algerian War and on French perceptions of Arab masculinity. His current research addresses post-colonial affirmative action and integration in France. The glimpse of his work you'll hear today focuses on Jean Sel and the myth of Trans-Mediterranean Traité des Blanches, 1962 to 1979. Our commentator is Naomi Davidson, who is a professor of history at the University of Ottawa. She studies France and North Africa, Islam and Judaism. Her book, Only Muslim, Embodying Islam in 20th Century France, appeared in 2012. That work and her current research on articulating Muslim-Jewish difference in Algeria during the Third Republic intersects with several themes addressed by the panelists. It's a little hard to imagine a better commentator than Naomi for this particular panel. Thank you and welcome again.
Okay. First of all, thank you, Susan, for that lovely introduction. Thank you so much, Ethan, for organizing this panel, and Naomi, in advance, for your comments. I'm actually going to begin with the genealogy of the paper that I'm going to deliver. It's slightly unusual because I'm not giving you an anecdote really from the paper, nor am I exactly presenting the historiographical framework, but bear with me. Basically, I want to give you a sense of why I wanted to write about Abraham Ankawa. It all started in 2011. I was sitting in on a conference on Algerian Jews organized by Sarah Stein and Susan Slimovich at UCLA, at which Ethan participated. And at the time, I was finishing up my dissertation, which was on Jews in the Moroccan legal system. And I was really much more of a Moroccanist. I'd never really worked on Algeria directly, and I was one of a few scholars who had sort of been invited to sit in on these Algerian-centered proceedings. And during the concluding discussion, I found myself really frustrated by how ubiquitously France and the French colonial presence had dominated the whole proceedings. This may not seem inherently objectionable here at the SFHS, but to a North Africanist, I was like, why do we always need to be talking about France in a conference on Algeria and Algerian Jews? Why can't we do something else? And I sort of said more or less that, slightly less pissy, I hope. And our colleague Josh Schreier, who wrote a book on Jews in early colonial Iran, offered a sort of possible direction. He said, in which one might take an exploration of Algerian Jews that wasn't so centered on France. And he talked about this Algerian rabbi named Abraham Ankawa, who had published a book in 1858 that had sparked this sort of international controversy in which rabbis from Algiers, Tunis, Jerusalem, and Livorno had all weighed in. And he had written a tiny bit about this in his book. And I nearly jumped out of my seat. Did I hear right? Ankawa? The Ankawa? I'm sure you're not all thinking that, but to Moroccan scholars, Ankawa is kind of a minor celebrity because he edited this incredibly important collection of Jewish communal ordinances from Fez, published around 1870, which basically absolutely every single scholar of Moroccan Jews knew and had used. The ordinances themselves date from all the way from the 16th century to the 19th century. They're just one of the most important primary sources. But of course, I had just assumed that Ankawa was a Moroccan rabbi, like all the other Moroccan rabbis that we encountered. And it was almost as if Ankawa had lived these two different lives, right? He had lived this Algerian life, and here he was known to Joshua Schreier and others as an Algerian rabbi working in Maskara. And then he'd lived this Moroccan life, and here he was known to all these Moroccan scholars as this Moroccan rabbi. And I was really struck by this and realized that, this mutual kind of ignorance is actually, I think, emblematic more broadly of the ways in which national historiographical frameworks continue to shape the way that history is done. So I'm not at all arguing in this paper that Algerian history or Moroccan history are entirely worthless as frameworks in which to study the past, but rather that there are certain individuals like Ankawa and certain questions and subjects, which I think really defy the limits of these categories and encourage us to look for others. So what I want to do today is use the life of Ankawa to argue that the frameworks in which the history of Jews in North Africa, and I think actually North Africa more broadly, are generally written are often inadequate to describe the trajectory of somebody like him, but also the experience of so many Jews and Muslims in 19th century North Africa more broadly. So just to give you a few kind of points, to give you a sense of what makes Ankawa fit very badly or not fit at all into these national boxes. Ankawa was born in Morocco, but moved to Algeria fairly young, in his 30s, where he made his career. He was appointed a rabbin délégué in Maskara, and that's where he lived most of his life. But he nonetheless continued to maintain his main intellectual networks with other Jewish scholars in Morocco. And this is particularly evident in his legal rulings, about which I'll speak a little bit more. And then he was also connected to this sort of Mediterranean-wide network of Jewish scholars, the nodes of which were located in Livorno, which is where he printed all of his books, in Jerusalem, in Tunisia, in Gibraltar a little bit, and in France. Now, of course, in many ways, Ankawa's life, I argue, was very transnational, but of course it was also very much shaped by the colonial context in which he lived. So it's not like I'm sort of arguing for ignoring France and French colonial rule, but rather just putting it into a broader sort of Mediterranean framework. And that's the kind of argument of the paper, that there's a Mediterranean framework that I think better captures his experience, and perhaps, we'll see, the experience of other Jews like him in the 19th century. And sort of lets us examine how Jews negotiated both the pressures and realities of colonial rule and the very strong, persistent, changing transnational networks that connected them to family, colleagues, business partners, etc., across the Mediterranean. So what I'll do today is sort of talk about three different episodes from Ankawa's life that I think illustrate these points. First, I'll talk about his legal rulings, his activities as a legal scholar. Then I'll talk about a controversy over this book that he published in 1858, which initially sparked my interest. And then finally, I'll talk about another controversy towards the end of his career in 1867, during which his sort of national allegiances were somewhat reified for him, and which actually ultimately proved his undoing. So first let me talk about him as a legal scholar. His works of jurisprudence, and particularly the publications of responsa that he put together around 1870, offer, I think, a particularly good example of why Ankawa as a scholar cannot really be considered within a national or even an imperial framework. So on the one hand, a large number of Ankawa's responsa were directed at the realities of practicing Jewish law in places where there was still a very significant Jewish legal autonomous system, particularly in Morocco, and really had absolutely no application to the Algerian context in which he was living and writing. So I'll just give you one example. In his collection from 1870, he includes a responsum about a man whose property was stolen while he was living and working in Fez. And the legal question at hand rests on whether the Jewish court would hold this Jewish merchant responsible for reimbursing his business partners for the losses, or whether they would have to seek compensation from a Moroccan Muslim court. Now, this question itself, of course, rests on the assumption that there is such a thing as a Jewish court that has jurisdiction over commercial matters, but which was very much the case in Morocco, right? In Morocco, there was a very robust Jewish autonomous judicial system until colonization in 1912. But in Algeria, where Ankawa was living and where he lived when these were published, Jewish courts had ceased to have the authority to rule on really anything other than personal status, and certainly not commercial matters, 30 years before the publication of this responsum. So in other words, there's really no question, I think, that Ankawa's legal ruling, and many others like it in this collection, I mean, this is by far not the only one, was really relevant to legal systems in parts of the Islamic world that had not yet come under colonial rule, and where Jewish courts remained autonomous. Nonetheless, he published it in Algeria. So that's one kind of view. On the other hand, Ankawa also published a number of responsa that very much addressed the new legal realities of living under French colonial rule in Algeria. For instance, which law should apply when Jews got married in both a Jewish religious ceremony and in the mairie, according to French civil law. And now there's a whole complicated trajectory that I'm not really going to get into of like how Jews were sort of slowly drawn into the French civil legal status even before 1870 when they were all made citizens, or the majority of them were made citizens. But anyway, what you basically need to know is that even before then there were many Jews who were getting married according to both laws. And in this case, Ankawa rules that French law should prevail. What's perhaps even the most interesting thing is that even in this responsum, which was very much about the Algerian colonial legal system, even this had a very sort of transnational element as it was published in his book of responsa, because Ankawa sent a draft of his responsum before publishing it to his colleague Rabbi Yitzhak Ben Gwalid living in Tetouan, who was one of Morocco's foremost scholars, and basically asked him, like, what do you think? You know, what do you think of this responsum? And Ben Gwalid wrote a letter being like, yeah, this is good. This is, I agree. You know, he made the right decision. And Ankawa publishes Ben Gwalid's letter to him right after the responsum in his book. So in other words, there's a way in which, you know, here he is producing Jewish law for Morocco in Algeria and producing Jewish law for Algeria, for which he asks the approbation of Moroccan rabbis. So there's, and this is in some ways, I think, really speaks to the way Jewish law was produced across political borders in a way that isn't so unfamiliar to Jewish historians, especially of the early modern period, but which is, I think, really important because, first of all, A, I don't think we understand that well how it worked, even in the early modern period. B, there's often this kind of assumption that, or certainly the way the historiography works is such that, you know, once nation states become preeminent, Jewish history also follows along national lines much more. But clearly what these responses are showing us is that actually the production of Jewish law continued to cross political boundaries very much in the 19th century. I also think that there's a way in which this trans-imperial legal production was not at all limited to Jews. People haven't worked on this so much in the Islamic context in North Africa, but they have started working on it in the Indian Ocean, and there are a few kind of little episodes from North Africa that people have written of, not to make the same point, but which I think actually ultimately do make the same point, that law especially transgressed political boundaries. So anyway, in sum, Ankawa as a legal scholar was very much somebody who lived betwixt and between Algeria and Morocco, and then even a kind of broader context, which I won't get into here, but anyway. Okay, now I want to pass on, to keep the pace going, I want to pass on to some of this sort of, these two big controversies that really marked Ankawa's life, and that I think also put into focus the ways in which he was really, both these episodes really put his trans-imperial ties into focus. And in the first episode, his trans-imperial ties really work in his favor. And in the second, they really prove his downfall. The first controversy erupted in 1858, shortly after Ankawa published a book, his first kind of major work, really, entitled Zvachim Shleimim, which is, anyway, the title really doesn't matter. It's just a kind of poetic title. He published it in Livorno with this famous mystic come book publisher named Elia Ben Amozeg, and, you know, shipped the books back to Algeria and distributed it among his, you know, colleagues in mainly in Iran, which was the big kind of intellectual center in Western Algeria. And a group of Jews in Iran immediately and very strongly objected to the book. Actually, interestingly, we still don't know exactly what their objection was. It seems like it was probably more of a personal controversy, kind of erupting into scholarship, which never, of course, happens today in academia. But in this case, it was not just a matter of getting bad reviews. Ankawa's detractors called for him to be imprisoned, you know, publicly displayed their disgust with his scholarship. They even ripped pages from the book and used these pages to wrap fish and meat, and worst of all, to use them as rolling papers for hand-rolled cigarettes, which was, you know, considered extremely disrespectful. And Ankawa was not one to stand idly by while people were literally trashing his work. And his first move was to collect letters of support from other rabbis around the Mediterranean. First he went to Algiers personally, and then kind of solicited letters via correspondence from rabbis in Morocco, Tunisia, Palestine, Italy, and eventually France, from the chief rabbi of France himself. Now, with the help of the president of the consistory, the consistoire of Iran, which was the sort of leading Jewish administrative body, Ankawa had these letters read aloud in all of the city's synagogues, basically to say, shut up, everybody, I know what I'm doing, and look at all these international authorities who are on my side. The president of the consistory, who was himself, by the way, also a Moroccan Jew, anyway, just ignore that. The president of the consistory also got the local prefect on their side, who mobilized the police just in case there were any unwarranted disturbances. I mean, indeed, when there was a slightly feisty crowd at a synagogue who seemed like they were about to kind of protest the reading of these letters aloud, the police immediately declared them, you know, outside the bounds of the law and squashed any protest. And indeed, Ankawa was, you know, mollified, and his work was kind of officially declared to be acceptable. And what's interesting is that his detractors made a kind of last-ditch effort to prove that they were right in the end. And what they did was they objected to the trans-imperial origins of these letters that had supported Ankawa, saying that their very trans-imperial origins disqualified the letters. They claimed that the letters were, quote, irreconcilable with the civilization of our country and came from foreign rabbis whose decisions have no legal authority in a French possession, end quote. In other words, what they did was try to fight Ankawa with claims of sort of modernity, right, civilization, and also with the primacy of the nation state, or at least of the sort of imperial context, right, that Algeria was, of course, already part of France. But these protests didn't fly, at least in 1858. Everybody was like, well, you know what, actually, the rabbis in Tunis and Jerusalem have a lot of authority in our community, and that's the way it is. And if they say that Ankawa's book is okay, then it's okay. Interestingly, these same kinds of trans-imperial versus sort of national controversies came up again about 20 years later. And Ankawa was not nearly as fortunate in this next controversy. In 1876, another controversy erupted around Ankawa. He was not a diplomatic person, shall we say. This time in the city of Mascara, where he worked and lived. As a rabbi, he was also a butcher and a dayan, a judge. And the controversy was sparked, again, a sort of minor incident. Basically, in a moment of rage, Ankawa got very angry at one of these other rabbis in the community and said, "Oi! Everybody who calls this man a rabbi should be excommunicated." And people, you know, news got out that he had said this, and people freaked out. There were clearly a lot of people who had, you know, built up resentment against Ankawa over the years in Mascara for one reason or another, and basically used this as a pretext to force Ankawa out of the community, to try to force the consistory of Iran to fire him from his job. Now, for our purposes, what is particularly fascinating is the way in which eventually this conflict became framed as one between, quote, Moroccan Jews, Ankawa being a Moroccan Jew, and native Algerian Jews. The Algerian Jews, who also at times styled themselves as French Jews, were the ones who were mainly against Ankawa, and who claimed that Ankawa was Moroccan and that he was supported by this faction of Moroccan Jews who were only loyal to one another, and who, moreover, were backwards and superstitious and antithetical to what France stood for. So one quote is, I think, particularly telling. The president of Mascara's Jewish community wrote, "I am well aware that Ankawa is supported by some foreigners who are attached to him through pure superstition, because Rabbi Abraham writes them amulets to cure certain illnesses, to make women give birth easily, etc. But we natives," he uses the word indigen, "we are the majority," end quote. So ultimately, in this case, this sort of foreigner versus French discourse won out, and Ankawa was forced into an ignominious early retirement against his will. Now, in some ways, this is a story about this sort of ultimate triumph of national categories like Moroccan, and I think it is in some ways emblematic of the changing role of the nation state in the Mediterranean, and the sort of, you know, in some ways the replacement of Mediterranean trans-imperial, transnational connections by a kind of national mosaic of nation states. However, I don't think that this is necessarily pointing to the death of the Mediterranean or the way in which the Mediterranean ceased to be a relevant category for people like Ankawa, because Ankawa did not actually transform into a Moroccan overnight, right? Even if he increasingly became labeled as such. I think, on the other hand, what this tells us actually is the way in which the nature of belonging in the Mediterranean shifted as nation-states became increasingly paramount points of reference, but also the trans-imperial ties that individuals had continued to persist as really important and formative. So I'll just take a minute and 10 seconds to conclude. In identifying Ankawa as somehow emblematic of the modern Mediterranean, I am very consciously bucking what I see as two historiographical trends that have dominated both Mediterranean studies and Jewish studies. In Mediterranean studies, the Mediterranean is normally thought to end in the modern period, right? The heyday of the Mediterranean is maybe either ancient or medieval or maybe early modern, but definitely by the modern period, the Mediterranean is no longer really all that important. And generally, this is sort of implicit in any association of the Mediterranean with Jews, right? Jews are called Mediterranean sometimes in the late antique and medieval periods, but never in the modern period. Jews are never thought to be sort of Mediterranean in that sense. But I don't think there's any good reason why the category of modern Mediterranean Jews should be an oxymoron. On the contrary, I actually think this lens, the sort of Mediterranean lens, can be extremely useful in order to see Jewish history, North African history, and French history in a different light, and in order to sort of bring these three fields together in a new way. Finally, and I think maybe most importantly for this panel and for this conference, I think Mediterranean can be a good kind of complement, or maybe even an alternative, to the French imperial framework. In large part because I think the Mediterranean gets us out of the metropole colony dyad, right? Obviously, there's been amazing work done on rethinking how that dyad works and recentering imperial history and recentering metropolitan history based on the colony, right? But I think there's also a lot more to be done on looking at the interactions between colonies and the broader regions in which they were situated, which were not necessarily within the same imperial order, right? So, so just in North Africa, there's just so much work waiting to be done on these trans-Maghrebi connections, which is starting slowly, but still, there's a lot more to be done. Now, this doesn't mean, of course, that we ignore colonial history, or that we say that France isn't important in shaping 19th century Algeria, but rather that we understand that colonial rule is really one among many forces at work shaping the lives of ordinary people living in Algeria, Jews, Muslims, whatever. So I'll stop there. Thank you so much for your attention, and I look forward to the rest of the papers and comments.